And we're joined now by the voice of the Kansas City Royals, Ryan Lefever. Talk Royals baseball. Royals with a win last night over the White Sox 2-1. Ryan there in Chicago. Ryan, how you doing, my friend?
Good, Wade. Good to talk with you.
It is good to talk with you as well. I guess I'll hit you with a question that might be somewhat difficult for some folks to explain, but that's why I have you on the show, because you are close to the team, travel with the team now once again on the road trips, as you and I were talking about off the air before you came on. And I think the first question is, what are the reasons for Royals fans, because this has been a rough year, no doubt, and more was expected of this team coming into the year. What are the reasons for Royals fans to be optimistic and to hang in there with this ball club?
Well, it's a good question, and it's a fair question, because not just this year, but last year, we really expected that the team would play better. And by the second half last year, it looked like that they had put things together, and we made some moves this offseason, and I was expecting that we'd be somewhere near 500. So it's been a very, very disappointing year, and I don't think anybody is trying to hide behind that and veil it with, you know, hey, we got all these young players up here, that's exciting. So no one's denying that. But I do know, and I've known this for years, that the Royals' belief has been that when we begin to win again, and for a sustained period of time, it's going to be with the young players that are starting to come up now. The hope was that with some free agents, we could ramp up, and when those guys came up here, they were in more of a winning environment, and that they could just, grab the baton from the guys that are playing right now and take that into another 3, 4, 5, 6 years, whatever, of winning. So it didn't work out that way. But Nick Prado is a big part of the Royals' future success. Vinny Pasquantino, MJ Melendez, Bobby Wood Jr., and they're all here. The starting pitching, for me, has been the biggest disappointment this year because of all those young guys that we drafted in the 2018 draft. This is their third year or parts of 3 years in the big leagues, and in the first half, you know, we had hoped that the rotation would be a strength, that in their third year they would hit their stride and show us some hope for the future, and that really didn't happen in the first half, but now it's beginning to happen in the second half. So I think Royals fans who remember how we got to 2014 and how we got to 2015 was with young players who played together in the minor leagues and went through the ups and downs in the big leagues, but through it all were talented. They had a desire to win. I think these guys might be even more physically talented than that group was, but that group had a drive about them that hopefully this group has. So it's not full-blown, positive mode right now, that just because these players are here, I mean, there's no replacing wins, and every win is important, and even in a losing season, every win means something because the guys learn how to win a baseball game, and we just haven't had enough of that. But the players that are important for the future are here, and they're getting major league experience.
Ryan Lefever, the voice of the Kansas City Royals, our guest today on the Sports Ticket. I'm glad you brought up the starting pitching, because you and I know, remember the days where the Royals had an unbelievable outfield and they had a really good offense. And Carlos Beltran was in center, Jermaine Dye in right, Johnny Damon in left. I remember watching many Royals games where the Royals would lose 10-8 or have a lead and the bullpen would blow it. And it was fun to watch these guys. I mean, Beltran, of course, a 5-tool player that could be a Hall of Famer. Dye was an all-star. Damon was an all-star. And that was fun, but the Royals didn't have the pitching to go with it. And so I'm excited about the guys you just mentioned, Melendez and Prado and certainly Bobby Witt Jr., but I'm with you. Until the Royals can find that pitching, I think the team will probably struggle, much like that team did back in those days.
Yeah, and that's fair. I mean, because as excited as we were in 14 and 15, and we can look back on those years and say, well, they had a lot of speed. Yes, they did. They were fundamentally sound on offense. They knew how to get one run across in a close game when they needed to. Their defense was outstanding. But, I mean, knowing that the game was pretty much over from the seventh inning on was a huge luxury. And if you look at how winning teams now build their bullpens, I mean, they're trying to copy what the Royals did, because prior to the Royals' run, every team had a closer, every team had a setup guy, And then maybe they had someone that they would rely on in the seventh inning, or a group of guys they'd rely on in the seventh inning. But the Royals had a seventh, eighth, and ninth guy, and they had guys they could use in the sixth inning. So the starters were good, not great, good enough. They gave the team innings. That was probably their biggest contribution during those years, was giving them innings so they didn't wear out the bullpen. And Mike Matheny just doesn't have a lot of options. And the Royals were outscored in the seventh inning or later more than any other team in the first half of the season. And so going back to those teams that you were talking about, yeah, and I'll throw in Joe Randa and Mike Sweeney. Mm-hmm. Carlos Fabelis was an exciting young player at that time.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it was a really exciting offense. The starting pitching I thought was good enough, but there were just so many games that were lost in the seventh, eighth, and ninth innings. And those are the worst ones to lose. Yeah. I mean, if you lose 8-1 and you pretty much know the game's over in the fourth or fifth inning, it stings, but not like working hard for 3 hours and then it all just crumbles, you know, in the last 10 or 15 minutes of the game. I mean, those are the ones that really linger. And when you win a game like the Royals did on Sunday in New York, I mean, those are the ones that can carry you for a while. Yeah. And then you come out and play a really good, crisp game like they did last night in Chicago.
Before we get to the trade deadline, which is at 5 o'clock today, and what the Royals may or may not do and what they've done already, I would be remiss if I didn't ask you about this. And, of course, it became a Kansas City story, then it blew into some people may say blown out of proportion, maybe it became a bigger story than it should have been, maybe it rightfully was a gigantic story. And that was when the Royals went to Toronto and 10 of the players on the roster were unvaccinated and didn't make the trip, and then the Royals brought up a lot of young guys, and they got the first win against Toronto. They were competitive in 3 of the 4. And, of course, Whit Merrifield's comments, and then some other people pointed out Hunter Dozier, let's not give him a pass. But there were a mixture of some veterans and some young guys. MJ Melendez is one that was not vaccinated either. How did you take all of that and covering all of that and understanding the dynamics of the clubhouse? Is that something that can be dividing in a clubhouse when you've got guys that, and I know it's a weird situation because nobody in sports has dealt with the vaccination side of things from this standpoint of, hey, we got 15, 16 guys vaxxed, we got another 10 that aren't, and thus they're not going with us to play 4 games in Toronto, and then of course Witt's comments, which he was trying to clear up after he had put those out there.
Yeah, it was a very complicated situation, and I felt a lot of pressure on Thursday coming on the air from Toronto, and I think we all knew that whether the fans understood the player's decision or they supported the player's decision or they were adamantly against the player's decision, we knew a lot of people were going to be watching that game and wondering how we handled it, and we're excited to see these young players. I mean, that's just what Royals fans have come to expect. They know that we're typically not going to be out there bidding with the big boys for free agents, that this is going to be built through trades and players from our farm system. So we knew that there was an interest there. And I'll tell you, Wade, I agonized all morning and afternoon about wording my comments correctly when I came on the air, because there were so many things involved. There was personal choice. There was international travel restrictions. You know, that's why they couldn't play, because they were not allowed to go into Canada and play. They could play in the other 29 stadiums, but they couldn't play in Canada. I mean, so that was a part of the story. And in fairness to Canada, I mean, it's just as hard to get into the United States from Canada being unvaccinated and if you're not a United States citizen. So it goes both ways. And the same Canadian restrictions kept the Blue Jays out of Toronto for a year and a half. They had to play in Buffalo. So when I came on the air, I mean, I was very careful with my words to just make sure that I presented all the facts and didn't take a side. And then, you know, the other side of it, too, was, look, the Royals knew this was coming. It's not like they were packing up for this trip and went, oh, my gosh, we got 10 guys who can't go. What are we going to do? I mean, they were prepared for this. So I think this speaks to Dayton Moore's integrity, because he was aware who these players were. They brought in doctors that were available for the players to ask questions if they had concerns about taking the vaccine, and so the Royals made those resources available, you know, the word leadership kept coming up, like, what kind of leadership does this show when 10 players, you know, don't go? Well, it's not a dictatorship, it's leadership. You can't force these guys to do this. But by the same token, you know, the Royals could have optioned a couple of players to AAA. Let's say they optioned two or three players to AAA. Okay, now the number's down to seven.
Right.
Michael A. Taylor's shoulder was sore. They could have put him on the injured list. Whit Merrifield was walking around in a boot. They could have put him on the injured list. Now you're down to five.
Right.
Cam Gallagher's been battling some things lately. You could put him on the injured list. You could have staggered it so it wasn't obvious. Okay, now the number's down to four. And just like most teams going in there, okay, are you happy now?
Yeah.
So they could have manipulated the roster, but by putting some of those guys on the injured list, the Royals would have to pay them for not being able to play. They would be not only guarding them, but they would be paying them. And so, you know, I applaud the organization. You know, we support the players, and this is a free country, and they had a choice to make. And by the way, none of these guys are any kind of zealots or radicals or anything like that. They just all have different concerns, and they've done their due diligence as well. And we may agree or not agree with them, but there's not a bunch of wackos, or the Royals are a team of a bunch of wackos. It's just they just chose to, you know, force these guys to be accountable for their decision, and it was their decision, and they had to deal with it. And I mean, and who knows how many of these cards are? I don't know what your card looks like, but my card looks like something that I could make on the computer and scribble a name in there, and is the Canadian Health Agency going to call my pharmacy in Kansas City and make sure that my vaccination is legit? I mean, who knows,
Yeah. You
know, how many teams are, you know, suddenly vaccinated right before the trip to Toronto. So who knows? There's a lot of stuff going on. And it was a fun 4 days. It was a lot of fun. I mean, they could have won three of the four. They won the first night, which was great. We had a huge audience, and the young guys came through and got some big hits. And so, there were so many facets to it beyond, you know, 10 so-called irresponsible players who, you know, didn't think about their team and decided to take four off. I mean, they suffered publicly, and they all suffered financially too.
I think the biggest thing out of that whole deal that rubbed a lot of Royals fans wrong, and you know what it was, that was Whit saying, well, you know, if it's the postseason, you know, you consider getting vaccinated. And that really rubbed fans the wrong way. And Whit's tried to explain and say, yes, and that's not how I want it to come across. It was a poor choice of how I worded it, how I phrased it. You know, Andrew Benintendi was just traded. He was one of those guys that wasn't vaccinated. Don't know for sure if he's going to get vaccinated for the Yankees. I would imagine there was something they discussed to where they had some kind of verbal agreement, but maybe not. What about that dynamic when somebody says that?
Yeah, well, you know, if you like a player that is going to speak his mind, and this seems to be a world right now where we applaud guys that just speak their mind, you know, and just get it out there and speak your truth and all that. Well, you know, sometimes it's not going to be what you agree with, and so you take what you like with, you know, what you don't agree with. And Whit has never shied away from speaking his opinion. This is the same guy when the team has been playing very poorly over the years that he will look directly into the camera after a game and essentially apologize for how bad they're playing, because he recognizes that fans are coming out and they're spending money and they're not winning, and how frustrated the players are, but he acknowledges how frustrated the fans are. And so that's the same guy. But I think his biggest mistake and what he's learned from this is just such an emotionally and politically charged issue that you really can't say anything right. I mean, no matter what you say, 50% are going to agree with you, 50% are not going to agree with you. So the guys that you didn't hear about at all were the guys that basically just didn't say anything.
Correct.
They just said, this is my choice, and that's the end of it. But to take it to another level and insinuate what he was insinuating, or at least that's the way it came across, was hurtful to the fan base, and I can understand why, and it was hurtful to his reputation. And I don't know how much longer he's going to be a Royal, but I can tell you, having been around Whit just about every single day since he's been called up to the big leagues, I mean, that's not – I really believe that Whit Merrifield wants to win.
Yes.
He wants to win. And all he's experienced is losing, and not just losing, but a lot of losing where he hasn't even been on a contending team. And so if he says that if he felt like we were going to contend – this year and had a chance to get into the playoffs, that might have changed his decision, then I'm okay with that. It's not just it wasn't just Kansas City wasn't good enough for me to get a vaccine, but another team might be. It was more directed toward a legitimate chance at getting to the postseason. And if he doesn't, he just didn't believe that that was the right choice for him and his body.
Yeah, and we'll never know. You know, if the Royals were 10 games over 500, maybe he would have got vaccinated and went to Toronto and played four games and so forth. We'll never know. Or if he gets traded here before the deadline today at 5 o'clock and he goes to a contender, we'll find out, you know, maybe he will or not get vaccinated. Although if nobody has to go to Toronto, you won't have to worry about that either.
Yeah, what if he gets traded to the Dodgers and the Blue Jays don't even make it to the postseason?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, right. Then it's a moot point, right? And Witt even said, he goes, sometimes I talk too much. I thought that was kind of an honest assessment. He goes, sometimes I talk too much, say too much. And probably if he would have stopped with the research comments and then not said something about the postseason or he'd consider otherwise, I think that was the line that got him in trouble, obviously. And we all make mistakes and say things, but I understand the fans being upset about that too, which leads me to the trade deadline, which is at 5 o'clock tonight. The Royals made a couple of moves yesterday, a little bit under the radar for a couple of pitchers, but I want to focus more on what they may or may not do. Of course, Andrew Benintendi has been traded, of course, to the Yankees, the only All-Star for the Royals this year. Michael A. Taylor is under contract next year. He's a guy that might, it sounds like the Braves and some other teams might be interested in him. Of course, a very good defensive player, Gold Glover, and would be a good addition to a team. Scott Barlow has been thrown out there a little bit in regards to he's a very good reliever, the Royals closer right now. He's going to turn 30, I think, later this year, perhaps it is. And then, of course, Whit Merrifield's another one that, you know, some Royals fans are like, let's just move on from Whit. Let's not have him block some young guy. Here's my question. I'm gonna kind of have a different angle for you, maybe. And that is, let me ask you this first. When do you think realistically is the next year the Royals will contend for a playoff berth? Do you believe that is next year, or do you believe that's more likely to be 2024?
Well, I'm terrible at predictions, and I mean I predicted that they'd be around 500
right
this year, you know, but there were injuries and underperformances and things that contributed to where they are. It's not an excuse for where they are, but
sure,
they were contributing factors. So I don't know, but if the pitching continues to grow the way it has in the last two or three weeks, I'm talking about the starting pitching, and the Royals have to address the bullpen next year. I mean, they're Mike Matheny needs to have more solid options when we get into the later innings. Well, if that happens and you start driving down the opponent's runs, then you don't need as much from your offense.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the four guys that we just talked about, Bobby Witt Jr., Nick Prado, MJ Melendez, and Vinny Pasquantino, are going to be a force to reckon with sooner rather than later at the major league level. They're going to have their ups and downs, but a force to be reckoned with. And so I think there's enough offense there for them to be a contending team. But it's all going to come down to how quickly the starting rotation continues to grow and having better options in the bullpen next year.
So here's my thought process. I'll answer my own question from this standpoint. I think to take the jump from where they are now to be right in the thick of a playoff race next year, I think is somewhat unrealistic. Not saying it's impossible. So I've targeted 2024. So if we want to go along with that premise, to me, if the Royals believe 2024 is the year that they really can seriously contend, maybe next year they can be, you know, right around the wild card in that last spot, possibly, who knows. You know as well as I do that the Royals are thinking way down the line in regards to planning, who's going to maybe play at this spot, who's a guy we can acquire that can help us down the line. Maybe one of those pitchers they acquired yesterday will be a guy that can be a part of this team in 2024. Here's a conversation we've had on this show quite a bit lately, and that is, I know it is hard to predict the future, but, you know, Salvi is off the IL and he's hitting home runs left and right, and that's terrific. Melendez is the catcher of the future, or is he going to be the right fielder? See, where I go with this is 2024, if Scott Barlow's part of the team, he'd be 31. Salvi's 2 years older. Whit Merrifield's 2 years older. You know, what's this lineup possibly look like? If Salvi is a DH, if he's older and you want Melendez to be your catcher, then, and Prado's your first baseman, I think everybody would agree he's probably the first baseman of the future. Where does Pasquantino fit in? Because where does he fit? Does Melendez end up being a right fielder so Salvi can catch every day? And I know that's a ways off, but to me, when you're looking at the trade deadline and getting to whether this year's trade deadline or next year's trade deadline, you don't want to have a log jam to keep a guy that's ready to go, that's major league ready, to go ahead and bring him up. At the same time, you don't want to, say, manipulate service time, but you do have a shorter window as a small market team, as you said earlier, to bring these guys up kind of at the same time so you can make a run like the Royals did in 14 and 15. Is that part of the equation when the Royals are thinking trades and trade deadlines and moves? Is when are we realistically going to be contending again? And do the current guys that maybe even are playing well but are older, like a Whit Merrifield, like a Salvador Perez, how do they fit in our plans? Or should we perhaps think about moving one or both of them so that we know that they're probably not going to be a big, big part of this in a couple years?
Yeah, there's a lot there in that question. Yeah. I will say, yes, it is part of the equation to start thinking about 2024 and 2025. However, I have yet to see a team that has decided on their own, okay, this is the year we're going to start winning. Mm-hmm. And when we get to spring training in 2024, before everybody takes the field, we're just all going to symbolically turn the switch on and say, okay, this is it, we're going to win. It just doesn't work that way. And I go back to something that we were talking about when you asked about the season, why should Royals fans be optimistic? And the fact that there are a lot of good young players on the roster right now. And what the Royals wanted, ideally, was that there would be a ramping up from a 90-loss team to a winning season, that you don't expect the team to make some massive jump from one season to the next. That usually doesn't happen. So I go back to something that Dayton said years and years ago when he became general manager. And Dayton said a lot of things that made sense, that I've heard versions of before, but I guess I'd never really seen a general manager truly live it out the way that he has. And one of the things that he said was every win at the major league level is important. So if the Royals win the World Series in 2025, let's say, okay, are we going to look back at the game that they won on Sunday at Yankee Stadium, or the game that they won last night here in Chicago? No, we're going to completely forget about those games. I mean, maybe if they go back to New York, we'll be like, remember that game? Mm-hmm. Salvi hit that home run. Remember that? And, you know, we're trying to, you know, we're dusting off the details of it to try and remember what happened. But it was a win, and the players learn something when they win. And whether they're winning 80 games or they're losing 100 games, every win helps the team get better. It teaches them how to win. And there have been trading deadlines in the past when we've had veterans and the team wasn't going anywhere that year, and fans were disappointed that Dayton didn't make more trades. Well, I can tell you that he knows the roster better than any of us know the roster.
Yes.
And he knows what we need and what he can get for every player. And he has to carefully decide, do we want to move this player on just for salary relief and not get anything in return, where he might still be able to help us win three or four more games in August and September that gives us momentum going into the next year? Are we going to get anybody in return that's going to help us? Mm-hmm. If not, you know, why are we making trades? And I think as fans, and I'll put myself in that category during the trading deadline, we can get caught up into thinking, well, just trade him. Just get something for him.
Right.
Well, guess what? You don't get better when you say, well, let's just get something for him.
Right.
I mean, you have to, and I think as an organization, you have to have pride in that. If you want one of our big league players that we think is a good player, you're going to have to give something up for it. Because there are plenty of teams out there that are just trading for salary relief and they're not getting anything in return. I mean, look at Carlos Santana this year. I mean, Carlos Santana could have been released in April or May, and the Royals end up trading him to Seattle and got some young pitchers for him. Now, are those young pitchers going to turn out to be anything? I don't know. But the patience really seemed to pay off. So, and I've learned just by observing Dayton's words that if you can't get anything in return that's going to make your team better in the future, but you have a chance to win some games in what seems like a lost season, I can see the value in that. The Royals finished, hopefully they finish strong this year. Hopefully they make some progress in 2023. And then getting back to your thought that maybe 2024 is the season, well, now you have a ramping, legitimate ramping up to 2024, not just deciding that 2024 is the year and who cares what happens the rest of the year and next year, because I can guarantee you that's not a good formula to become a winning team in 24.
No, I hear you. The top guys in the minors that are close to Major League Baseball ready, from what you're hearing from everyone in the organizations, like Drew Waters, obviously is playing very well. They acquired him from the Braves. He could be very well the center fielder of the future. That's why Michael A. Taylor may be expendable in a trade if, as you said, and I've said this as well, when people want Whit Merrifield traded, I say I think there is value in Whit Merrifield. Some people try to tell me there's not as much value in Whit Merrifield. I say I think there's value in Whit Merrifield. Somebody will give something up for Whit Merrifield, but the question is how much or is it enough? And if and you just don't trade him to trade him. So I agree with you on that. Michael A. Taylor, you just don't trade him to trade him, but at the same time, if you do trade him and you think Drew Waters is ready, then you open up the spot for Drew Waters. Is there anybody, or would you agree, first of all, that Drew Waters is close to being Major League Baseball ready? And then two, is there anybody else you're hearing down in the minors that may be close to coming up or make an impact, whether it be this year or perhaps early next year?
Well, the Royals brought up players strategically for those games in Toronto. I mean, they didn't just grab guys to, you know, come up and get Major League experience. So Nick Prado comes up, and they thought he was ready because he ended up staying with the team after everyone else went back to the minor leagues. The team is really high on Michael Massey, who can play second base. He played a little bit at third base in the Toronto series. They really, really like him. Nate Eaton hit a home run in Toronto. The Royals are high on him as an outfielder. They have an outfielder, infielder, Nick Lofton, that I know they're very high on, and I think he recently has made the jump from AA to AAA. And you mentioned Drew Waters. But, you know, the jump between AAA and the major leagues is a big one. And fans were, you were asking about Vinny Pasquantino earlier. You know, fans were just clamoring, you know, yes, bring up Vinny Pasquantino because of the numbers that he was putting up in AAA. And this feeling that, well, bring him up and let him get major league experience. None of us should make the mistake. When I say none of us, I mean none of us should ever make the mistake in thinking that we know better when a player should be called up from the minor leagues than the Royals do.
Yeah.
And it's never going to be for financial reasons. Dayton, I've heard Dayton say that in a room full of minor leaguers, that they will not manipulate their service time or wait to save a year of arbitration or whatever. And they proved that when they brought up Eric Hosmer in 2011. So I firmly believe that. But I've also seen, and I've been doing this a long time now, I've seen a lot of players come up that were not physically ready, or more importantly, they were not emotionally ready for this level. Mm-hmm. They don't play well, and they end up never playing well.
Yeah.
And to bring a kid up here that's not ready for it, mm-hmm, and they fail, and if they fail bad and they go back to the minor leagues questioning whether they belong here or not, can be fatal for a player's development.
Yes.
And it just seemed to happen year after year after year before Dayton got here, and Dayton was very, very careful about that. So the Royals took their time with Vinny Pasquantino because there were things that he was doing at AAA that he was getting away with that they knew he was not going to get away with at the major league level. And as it turns out, he's done okay. You know, he's hit into some bad luck, but he's hit the ball hard. They're trying to find ways to get him some time in the field so that he's not you know, a designated hitter from this point forward. They've had to be creative in moving guys around the field. But there is a science, and they're not always right. They don't always have the perfect date to bring a player up. But I remember this from when I first became a major league broadcaster with another team that had young players coming up, and I heard something I've never forgotten, that it's much better to call a player up a month too late than it is a month too early.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yes, some of those guys are fun to watch in the minor leagues, and it's fun to dream about them at the major league level, but I can tell you this front office is very sensitive to and very aware of the timing when it's right to bring a guy up to this level.
I've always said that baseball and golf, I think, are the two toughest sports mentally. And if you don't have it mentally, you're in deep, deep trouble. So I totally agree with you. And just to piggyback on something you said there, and then we'll get to our off-the-ball question and let you go. Ryan LaFever, the voice of the Royals, our guest today on the Sports Ticket. I was encouraged by the guys you mentioned there, but I did happen to notice all the guys you mentioned, unless I missed something, that are close to being Major League Baseball ready are all position players. Now that's the concerning part to me. You didn't mention any pitchers that, you know, that's still the whole key to this process, isn't it?
Well, most of them are already here.
Yeah, true.
And
but,
you know, you got Jonathan Bolin in the minor leagues. The Royals are excited about him. You know, he's another guy from that draft. Jonathan Heasley is in a, you know, back in the minor leagues right now after being on the injured list, and so most of them are already here. And some of those guys, I believe, well, they have to, are going to end up being relievers. When the season began, I mean, the rotation had more pitchers than it did available spots in the rotation. So, you know, Kelvin Herrera was a starter once upon a time. Greg Holland was a starter once mm-hmm. upon a time. Not in the major leagues, but they were in the minor leagues. I mean, Wade Davis with the Rays and even with the Royals was a starter. Luke Hochaver was a starter. So some of those guys that are either here or they're in AAA and they've been here before, Carlos Hernandez is another guy. There are plenty of arms that are ready to contribute at the major league level, but the Royals just have a lot of sorting out to do to figure out, okay, who's going to be a starter and who do we need to start transitioning into the bullpen.
All right, off-the-wall question on Isle of Fever.
Here we go.
Yeah, we've had you on before. I remember one time you were talking about the Bee Gees. I mean, we go all kinds of directions.
Yeah.
What's your doppelganger, all right? And I'll give you a chance to think about it because – I'm going to tell you right now, and maybe I'm imagining things and I'm getting older, I'm in my mid-40s, but I just want to say that before Andrew, and I thought this before, but it really hit me with the camera shot when Andrew Benintendi was taking practice swings before he came to the plate on TV, there was a shot of him from the side, and I immediately, it confirmed everything I had thought before, but maybe I need my eyes checked, and I was like, dude, that looks like a young Ryan Lefevre. That, from the side, Andrew Benintendi looks like Ryan Lefevre's doppelganger. Now, he had a batting helmet on and all that, but from the side, it looked like that could have been Ryan Lefevre, you know, in his mid to late 20s, around 30 perhaps. Anybody else say anything to you about Andrew Benintendi looking a little bit like you?
Well, beginning with my mother, yes.
Okay.
And it was opening day last year in his first at-bat, and I think... You know, he always had some sort of facial hair, uh-huh. if I recall, and I think he even had it in spring training last year. But before opening day, I think he shaved, and so we got a different look of Andrew Benintendi. But in that very first game, maybe that first at-bat of opening day of last season, the text came from my mom, and, I mean, it didn't stop for most of last season. Now, we weren't on the field and traveling with them, so I never got a chance to meet him.
That's true.
So, you know, finally this year I had a chance to meet him, and he was just great to talk to, just such an interesting, even-keeled guy. I wasn't going to bring it up to him. It would be strange enough for me to go up and introduce myself to him and say, hey, everybody in Kansas City thinks that we look alike, and by the way, for better or for worse, this is what you're going to look like when you're 51 years old.
With four
kids. I never brought it up, you know, and he never brought it up, but yeah, I've heard that more than any other player that we've had since I've been in Kansas City.
Well, I figure you have a little bit less hair than he does because you do have four children, so, you know.
That's right, and I'm a lot older than he is, too.
That's true.
But I couldn't hit like he could, I can tell you that.
No doubt. Sweet swing. Is there anybody else that you've ever been a doppelganger other than Benintendi? I'm glad to know that I'm not imagining things. That's good.
You know, I've heard Denzel Washington before. But I think that's more in reference to, you know, just overall masculinity,
yes,
and intensity.
No doubt.
In a great movie scene.
No,
so no, I would use that as a joke all the time. But when I was young, and when I say young, junior high school. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we go back to the early mid '80s. I grew up in Santa Monica, California. And there were a group of actors at that time that were in all the teen movies, you know, The Outsiders and 16 Candles and whatever, all those popular movies in the 80s. A lot of those guys grew up around Santa Monica. So they had preceded my group of friends at our schools before we got there. And the one that I used to get a lot then, and I say then, I make this very clear then, because he's way better looking than I am now, and he is held on to his looks and his age way better than I have.
Mm-hmm.
But I used to get the Rob Lowe, a young Rob Lowe.
Wow.
Don't Google him now. Don't Google him and me now. Go back to the early 80s. And for whatever reason, I don't know why, Wade, I hated it. The girls at the junior high school would bring it up all the time, and we had the same initials, and I just hated it. And I was in French class. I was taking French as a seventh grader. And I was trying to answer a question in French and probably doing a terrible job of it, much to the dismay of my French teacher, who recognized my very French last name, that I was bumbling the language of my roots. She said, "You know, you remind me of a student that I used to have." And three shrieking classmates of mine, girls, said, "Is it Rob Lowe?" And her eyes got as big as the sun, and she said, "It is Rob Lowe." And they screamed, and they went on and on. And what should have been like a great moment of my life, that I was being compared to this very popular, good-looking Hollywood actor. Yeah. I mean, I was just devastated. There was no escape now that one of Rob Lowe's former teachers said that I reminded her of him. So
now looking
that
back,
was a terribly long story, and I hope everybody listening somehow gets those last 10 minutes of their life back.
Looking back, you now can appreciate that, and you probably are more upset now that there is no longer maybe the comparison, right?
No chance. He's done he's done way better since then than I have.
Hey, I love the story. That's why I like the off-the-wall question, something a little bit different. Hey, man, always a pleasure talking to you. We definitely need to do this a little bit more often if you're available to do so. We haven't had you on in a while. And, of course, I know a lot of things changed quite a bit during the COVID years and not traveling with the team and everything else. So I'm glad you're able to travel again with the team. Of course, you'll be in Chicago tonight, and we look forward to the call. And stay safe, my friend, and we will talk to you again soon.
Hey, always enjoy chatting with you too, Wade. Thank you.
Take care. Ryan LaFever, the voice of the Kansas City Royals, our guest today on the Sports Ticket.